We are beginning the Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. In today's show, Dr. Justin Sledge with a very interesting talk on Lilith, who has a wonderful YouTube channel called Esoterica. And I feature music by a group in Taiwan called A Moving Sound. Lovely music. First a calendar, and then the interview with Dr. Justin Sledge. The hit Star Wars burlesque parody, The Empire Strips Back. Playing in Los Angeles now through January, this previously sold-out experience drops classic sci-fi characters into the world of burlesque. EmpireStripsBack.com for more information. It's at the Montalban Theater in Hollywood. The Actors Gang bids adieu to 2022 in Shambles, the Cirque-infused immersive holiday extravaganza. Tickets at theactorsgang.com. This starts December 8th, 12 performances only, at the Ivy Substation in Culver City, Q Theater. At the Wallace, through December 18th, Romeo and Juliet, reimagined through the music of Pat Benatar. TheWallace.org for more information. Go to BroadwayInHollywood.com if you want to find out about musical theater in Los Angeles at the fabulous Dolby and Pantages Theaters. They're featuring Annie, The Sun Will Come Out through December 18th, The Book of Mormon through December 11th, Jesus Christ Superstar at the end of the month, and also Harry Connick Jr. and Lindsey Stirling around the holidays. Again, BroadwayInHollywood.com for more information. And lastly, the LA Phil's 2022 Deck the Hall Holiday Concert Series, featuring The Nutcracker with Dudamel. That'll be on December 14th and 18th. Symphonies for Youth. Dudamel conducts The Nutcracker December 10th and 17th. A Chanticleer Christmas, that's December 13th. Home Alone in Concert, December 20th through the 22nd. Arturo Sandoval, Swinging Holiday, December 23rd. And New Year's Eve with the Roots, that will be December 31st. LAPhil.com for more information. This series features star-studded vocalists, blockbuster movie screenings performed with orchestra, notable conductors, and family-friendly fun, all in celebration of the winter holiday season. Once again, LAPhil.com for more information. Okay, now, stay tuned for the talk by Dr. Justin Sledge.
Abrahamic mythology represents one of the longest continually developing religious traditions in the world, from its origins in ancient Canaan to postmodern theology and mysticism. Yahweh, various angels such as Michael and Gabriel, of course, the demonic forces led by Satan or Belial or Beelzebub or Samael, take your pick, have all come to become household names, not to mention, of course, Jesus, Muhammad, gens and thousands of pages of religious scripture. For over 3,000 years, Abrahamic mythology has developed, spread, and flourished on the world stage of religion. But one figure in that mythology finds their origins well before angels and archangels, before messiahs and prophets, before perhaps even Yahweh. The figure of the demoness Lilith reaches back in some form to ancient Sumerian and Babylonian mythology, but came to flourish especially in later Jewish mythology. Indeed, it's arguable that no other figure has undergone such development, from divine being to rebellious first wife of Adam, to an infant murdering demoness, to a being of primordial evil, a wife of the anti-god Samael, then split into younger and older variants, said to have been hewn from the divine throne itself, to even becoming the divine consort in later Kabbalistic speculations, and finally, a feminist icon in the 20th and 21st centuries. Lilith, the Maiden of the Night, is truly one of the most remarkable figures in the entire history of Abrahamic mythology. In this, at least two-part series, I'll be exploring the origins and development of Lilith. In this first episode, I'll be covering Lilith's ancient origins and transformation in rabbinic literature before turning in the second episode to her dramatic, even shocking, development in the mystical Kabbalistic literature. But now, let's explore the complex origins and development of Lilith, the Night Maiden. I'm Dr. Justin Sledge, and welcome to Esoterica, where we explore the arcane in history, philosophy, and religion. If one were to travel back in time to the streets of ancient Babylon around 2000 BCE and inquire among the Ashipu or the Mashmashu, the ritual experts in that time, about the god Yahweh, the angel Michael or Raphael, the watchers Semyaza or Satan, they would probably just look back at you in a confused stare. Indeed, those mythological beings were centuries, if not millennia, from being developed in the crucible of apocalyptic Judaism much, much later. But if one were to inquire of those Ashipu or the Mashmashu about the Lili or the Lilitu in Akkadian, one might very well see the blood flee from their face in dread terror. Lilith, in some form and in various numbers, has haunted the imagination of people long before monotheism, dualism, long before any Yahweh or Satan. In fact, Lilith may well be the oldest surviving mythological figure in all of Abrahamic mythology. Though, as we'll see, the origins and development of Lilith is anything but simple. It appears that the earliest conception of a Lilith wasn't a singular, distinct being or personality, but a class of apparently malevolent sub-gods, or what we might call demons, the Lilu along with the Lilitu, and Ardat Lili, at least in Akkadian, or the Maiden Lilith, seem to have been largely creatures that dwelled in remote or deserted regions of the earth, and were especially dangerous to pregnant women, to babies, and also even to young men. Some Lilu and Lili, these are both Akkadian versions of the Sumerian Lil, may have also been associated with insanity and wind demons, such as their purported leader, Pazuzu. Come back to him in a minute. Ardat Lili especially seems to have been a kind of perpetual bride-to-be whose sexual dysfunction causes her to target young men, perhaps a kind of proto-succubus-like figure. However, A, or the male Lil in Sumerian, is taken to have been the father of none less than Gilgamesh, like Epic of Gilgamesh, who actually goes on to encounter a Ki-Sikililake, a spirit primarily dwelling in sacred trees, though both the reading of that in Sumerian and the meaning of that expression is still hotly debated. The Burney relief may depict a lily. The association with the owls in that image are kind of speaking in that favor, but there's absolutely no agreement among scholars, with arguments that that's actually Ishtar, who ironically seems to have actually had an antagonistic relationship with the Lili. It could be Ishtar's sister and the queen of the underworld, Erishkigal, to some otherwise totally unknown figure. Who knows about the burning relief? Regardless, the Lilu and Lili form some complex, though admittedly unclear, aspect of the demonological ecology of ancient Mesopotamian religious life. However, it seems that an etymological mistake between the isolate Sumerian and Semitic Akkadian languages would eventually allow for a kind of fusion between the sub-divine beings of the Lilu-Lili family and the daughter of Anu and a proper goddess, Lamashtu. This can be seen in how the Lilu-Lili aren't written with the divine determinative like Lamashtu is. what seems to happen is a kind of linguistic assimilation where some of the malevolent activity of the Lili are fused with the explicitly anti-naval evil of Lamashtu, who of course was known to kill unborn children either by tapping on the mother's stomach 7 times, of course murdering babies through crib death, or even just kidnapping them from a wet nurse. Lamashtu's infamy is actually well attested in the amulets and spells, the numerous spells and amulets against her, which actually deploy the iconography of the leader of the Wind Lilu, Pazuzu. Of course, Pazuzu gets a super bad rap because the exorcist kind of did him dirty by making him possess that young girl, Reagan, but that's actually considerably ironic if you think about the fact that he was invoked precisely as a protector of young children and mothers. So, sorry, Pazuzu. What appears to have happened is that some of the characteristics and functions of the Lili, especially including Ardat Lili, seem to have been fused with the more explicitly antenatal evil of Lamashtu, with a kind of false friend relationship between the etymologically unrelated Sumerian term for those beings, Lil, and the Semitic Akkadian word for night, Lilum or Liliatum, thus seeming to give rise to a pan-Mesopotamian demoness, attested in later Phoenician, Israelite, Jewish, Persian, Mandean, you name it, texts. Sources largely responsible for crib death, seducing young men in their sleep, etc. Now, exactly how this process developed isn't totally understood, and it probably won't ever be understood. But it seems possible, likely to me, that through a linguistic mishap and a bit of divine demonic assimilation, Lilith, as we know her, came into being. What might be the earliest evidence of this fusion may be a 7th century BC amulet found at Arslan Tash in what is now northern Syria. This amulet is really interesting in several respects. One, it shows Lilith as a demoness, thus leaving her cradle in Mesopotamia. Sorry for that cradle joke. And entering into the Levant. Second, the inscription is in Phoenician and not Akkadian, showing cultural diffusion of the Lilith myth. And finally, the amulet may actually be our earliest depiction of Lilith as a kind of Sphinx-like being. However, both the reading and the meaning of the inscription are heavily contested by scholars, with that final T, Lilith, being hugely in question. So, is this Lilith? It seems possible, maybe likely, but the jury is out and will likely remain so forever. The next possible appearance is also contested, but it's also the first and only mention of Lilith in ancient Israelite literature, that is, in the Hebrew Bible or the Christian Old Testament. At Isaiah 34:14, the prophet there is describing the Yom Yahweh, or the coming day of divine justice, in which all the nations that oppressed Israel will be divinely destroyed and devastation will be everywhere, and describes the condition of those nations such that jackals shall meet hyenas, goat demons shall greet each other, there too Lilith shall repose and find her resting place. The problem is that the Hebrew for all those creatures I just mentioned is highly uncertain and remains very poorly understood to this day. In fact, the great Isaiah scroll found at Qumran, the most complete ancient Isaiah scroll we have, the term Lilith there is actually in the feminine plural, Liliot, which better matches the literary flow of the text anyhow. What is clear is that these animals, or maybe demons, are associated with ruined or otherwise deserted places or destroyed places, and that's actually pretty typical of demonic beings in ancient Mesopotamian mythology more generally, and we'll see it's something that's inherited directly into Jewish demonology as well. Again, is this Lilith a class of demonic beings or a specific demonic being? Or a demonic being at all? Indeed, note there's no antenatal violence invoked here either. Actually, a recent study has argued that none of the beings typically invoked as proto-demons in the Hebrew Bible, like Dever and Reshef, these are sickness, plague demons, Shadim, Seraim, those are the goat demons, or Lilith, Liliot, I guess. A recent argument is made that they're not demons at all. Judith Blair has actually made a very cogent argument, at least to to my mind, but these are just ritually impure animals, with Lili just being a kind of owl or something. Though, think back to the Burney relief in this regard. It seems like owls kind of got associated with these beings. But again, the Hebrew is so poorly understood and the cultural context utterly lost that we're probably never going to understand what those few verses in Isaiah ever meant with any certainty. And strangely, despite the positive explosion of both angelic and demonic beings during the period that most scholars refer to as Jewish apocalypticism, think of the Book of Enoch and literature like that, Lilith is conspicuously absent in what are otherwise dozens of foundational texts in the genre, many brimming with such supernatural creatures. In fact, one of the sole references to Lilith, or a Lilith-like being, is likely an exorcistic text in the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Song of the Sage, it's 4Q 5, 10, and 11. In this text, Lilith occurs in the singular in the exorcistic invocation, which, compared to the Great Isaiah Scroll, also recovered from Qumran, which again had it in the plural. Again, are we dealing with Lilith or something else here? It's so hard to know. Further development of the Lilith mythology would occur, interestingly enough, closer to her original homeland over there in Mesopotamia. In virtually parallel development, the mythology of Lilith would begin to more fully coalesce in both the Babylonian Talmud and in Mesopotamian incantation bowls, before reaching its mythological maturity just before the time period of what we might think of as the European Middle Ages. The Talmud, as you might recall, is a commentary on an earlier text of Jewish lore called the Mishnah. Two such of these commentaries were produced. There were two Talmuds produced, one over in Palestine and the other in the academies of Babylon during the Sasanian period. While the Mishnah itself contains no Lilith references, she does get about a half a dozen mentions in the Babylonian Talmud. For instance, we learn in Tractate Eruvin that one of the punishments meted out to women because of the sin of Eve is that they have to grow long hair like Lilith, which doesn't seem like a super bad punishment. At Gittin 69b, we learn of a treatment for Gira. This might be a kind of striking or stinging pain in one's body that involves some kind of stone known as the arrow of Lilith, Gira de Lilita. There's a pun there between the pain gira and the arrow gira in the Aramaic, and that's probably how the magical idea happens. At Nida 24b, we learn that if a woman has a stillbirth which resembles Lilith in that it has wings, that such a fetus is viable and that that woman is tamei, or susceptible to the laws around ritually uncleanliness following childbirth. At Bava Batra 73a through b, we read a super strange narrative in which a character called Hormin, this is apparently the son of Lilith, is performing all kinds of acrobatic feats while holding a glass of wine that never spills. Shockingly, by the way, this is probably a reference to the Zoroastrian deity Ahura Mazda, the god of light and goodness. Ironically here, made the son of the demoness Lilith, so the Talmud throwing some shade at the Zoroastrians for some reason. Don't pick on the Zoroastrians. They have a hard enough time. They're wonderful people. At Shabbat 151b, Chanina Mendoza warns us to never sleep in an empty house because, of course, you'll be seized by Lilith. So don't do that. And in a final reference, we find a debate about the fate of Adam in the years after his expulsion from the Garden of Eden. In a very weird narrative at Eruvin 18b, we learn that in those 130 years following the exile from the garden, Adam, probably through nocturnal seminal emissions, begat a whole race of Ruchin v'Shedin v'Lilin. Now, exactly how to translate those terms is not clear because Talmudic demonology is notoriously unsystematic. I've done an episode about that if you want to check it out. But it might mean something like spirits, shade demons, and Lilith demons. But it could just as well be something else. Note there that Lilin is in the masculine plural and not in the feminine singular or feminine plural. But the whole phrase might mean something like spirits and male and female demons, but it's not terribly clear. A few final pieces of rabbinical literature will also help us reveal the development of the Lilith myth, and those can be found primarily in later Midrashic, or legendary commentaries on the Bible. In Genesis Rabbah, we find a really interesting discussion caused by what is apparently a lacuna in the biblical text. You may remember that before Cain and Abel went out into the field, they were discussing something, but there's a gap in the Hebrew Bible's text there. There should be a discussion of what they were discussing. Well, they go off into a field and things don't go well so for Abel, and so we never learn what they were talking about. So what were they talking about? One of the varied topics mentioned in that discussion was they were arguing about the Chava HaRishona, or the first Eve who returned to the dust. Now, while Lilith isn't explicitly mentioned here, the idea that Adam had a first wife that got away, that's going to matter a whole lot more in just a minute. In another Midrash at Bamidbar 16, where Moses is yet again arguing with Yahweh not to kill everyone, as Yahweh is wont to do, one of the arguments provided by Moses is that if he does in fact kill all the Israelites, Yahweh will be compared to Lilith, who kills her own children. Not a good look, buddy. Not a good look, Yahweh. Note, this is the first time in the rabbinical literature so far that we have the motif of Lilith as a child killer, though the reference here is to her killing her own children, which is ironic considering that in most of the medieval literature, the fully developed literature on Lilith, she'll be depicted as a rage-filled demoness precisely because of her inability to have her own children. Again, a crucially important part of the development of her legend and how she's integrated into Judaism, where she will survive in the mythology for ages. However, the threat of Lilith against mothers, babies, and children was also being developed at the same time in the magical technologies of the same cultural and historical milieu as the Babylonian Talmud. In dozens, maybe hundreds of incantation bowls, Lilith is both described, abjured, and even widely depicted for the first time. Now, these incantation bowls were typically a kind of magical device containing a magical text written often in a circle or a spiral with a depiction of the demonic entity that's being targeted at the center of them, which is typically depicted as being wrapped up in chains. And they were typically buried in ritually important parts of the home, often beneath the lintel of the house. This magical technology is widely observed with the language, in the case that it's not pseudo-writing, just squiggles, those probably were sold to illiterate people, sorry. They often indicated the religious or ethnic background of the user. So Hebrew Aramaic, probably Jews, Mandaic, probably Mandaeans, Persians, probably Zoroastrians, etc. Lilith is one of the most widely attested demons depicted and exorcised in these bowls over all ethnic groups, with her long, unkempt hair almost always giving her away. In general, the bowls contain two types of invocations, one which protect women and babies and children from Lilith, and sometimes even male Liliths, so he's still around, and two, those which protect men from her and her more succubus-like form. These are often even combined. In both cases, divine and angelic names are invoked to banish Lilith from the home and protect those inside. It's also worth noting that many of the bowls in the incantations actually operate as a kind of get, or a bill of divorce from Lilith. In these cases, there may have been a nocturnal ejaculation taken to have been caused by Lilith as a kind of succubus, which would have effectively married the man of the house with Lilith. Thus, you would require a get or a bill of divorce to get rid of her. In some cases, there may have even been offerings made to operate as a kind of ketubah, or alimony, for Lilith to get her to go away. In yet others, Lilith would be threatened with karet, or excommunication, a kind of ban that subjected her to indiscriminate divine wrath. Now, incantation bowls are a huge genre of ancient magical technology, and I'll be coming back to do an entire episode just on incantation bowls at some point, but nevertheless, they are an important early attestation to the nature and the powers of Lilith. However, it would be in the pseudepigraphic alphabet of Bin Sirah, composed sometime around 700 or 1000 of the Common Era, that the myth of Lilith would reach maturity. In that text, Lilith appears for the first time as the first partner of Adam, made from the same clay that he was, and thus equal to him by all rights. Famously, she asserts this equality by insisting on being on top during an act of sexual intercourse for which Adam refuses. It's kind of vanilla. And in defiance, Lilith pronounces the ineffable name of God and disappears into the air. Adam, for his part, cries out to God to bring her back, and God, for God's part, sends three angels to do just that, Sinoy, Sansanoy, and Samangalaf. The deal would be simple. She just has to come back and all is forgiven, and she has to be on the bottom and stay free, but 100 of her children must die every day. The three angels actually corner her over the Sea of Reeds, where the Pharaonic army would one day be drowned, and they threaten her. But again, defiant Lilith counteroffers. She'll accept the death of 100 of her brood each day, but she'll be able to stalk the children of humans for 8 days after a boy's birth and for 20 days for a girl. However, she'll be forever deterred by the powerful names of those angels, Sinoy, Sansinoy, and Samangalaf, such that if she sees their names over a child, she'll relent and the child will recover. In this brief tale, thousands of years in the making, these mythological strands fuse into a truly enduring narrative. Lilith, the defiant first partner of Adam, becomes the murderer of infants in her fury, which can only be repulsed through angel magic. And indeed, it's around the time of the production of the Alphabet of Bin Sirah that we find the first Aramaic incantation formulae appear with the now commonplace incantation, Adam v'Chava, Chutz Lilith, Adam and Eve, out, Lilith, along with the talismanic angel names, Sinoy, Sansinoy, and Samangalaf. A formula still reprinted in handbooks of Jewish magic down to today. I have them right there, and more on those amulets, modern amulets for this, in a future episode. However, in a lesser known and largely lost text, sadly, which is terrible because it must have been a compendium of ancient demonology and the Midrash Abkir, this portrays Adam as a kind of saintly figure, unlike the depiction from the Talmud that we mentioned earlier, where he kind of goes on a demoness fornication bender. Sounds good. He's actually ascetically separated himself from Eve in this story, following their sin and the murder of Abel by their son Cain, which introduced both death and murder into the world. Thanks, Adam. However, in this account, Lilith is actually so powerfully attracted to Adam, he sort of gleams like the sun, that she forcibly mates with him, probably when he's asleep, and over the course of 130 years of his isolation, he sires myriads of hosts of demons, which go on to plague humankind down to this day. I suspect that she was probably on top in those nightly romps, so Lilith laughs last. This motif of Lilith as a succubus would also prove influential in the next period of the development of her mythology, the Lilith of the Kabbalah. In this episode, we've covered the development of the Lilith myth spanning millennia, from Bronze Age Mesopotamia to right up to the dawn of the Kabbalah in the 13th century. As we've seen, Lilith is an enduringly powerful myth which captures a range of fears and anxieties, from crib death to female autonomy, a subject that still strikes terror in basic bros everywhere. In the next episode, we'll turn to the fantastically psychedelic and multifaceted development of Lilith within the scope of the mystical revolution inaugurated by the Sefer Zohar, or the Book of Radiance, and the rise of the Kabbalah. In those mythological developments, Lilith will reach new primordial depths of evil. Her evil will be preexistent to even Yahweh, and she will rise to become nothing less than the very consort of an admittedly unwilling Godhead, before her final destruction, which, unlike virtually all other demons, can only come at the advent of the final messianic days. In this way, Lilith certainly pre-existed the Abrahamic mythologies and will very likely be with them to the very end, if not beyond. I'm Dr. Justin Sledge, and thank you for watching Esoterica, where we explore the arcane in history, philosophy, and religion.
Hello, friends of Misty Pete on KXLU.
This is Scott.
And Mia from A Moving Sound in Taiwan.
We met in New York City in 2001. I decided to move to Taiwan after she said she wouldn't move to New York, and it's been non-stop music making since then.
Our original music combines traditional instruments and contemporary vocals. We've performed in 20 countries, including Red Cat Theater and Ground Performance in LA. And we will be on the East Coast to perform in next March.
We are very grateful and delighted that Pete is going to share our newest international release, Starshine, with you.
It's our third international release from Arc Music. We think you will find it full of mystery and joy.
Thank you. 다 요한이 사랑 노래듯이 무무이무이무를 나나와도 무자본 고라스 나간지략은 시야마 다니시리나 야마미 야마라이안 마누
Thank you.
No.
비도하면세면순덩시게해더대건배미니게게무게헝허리시아미슈호터대
进行脱离公杯，
李大兄，
正手拿乖呀，倒手提元宝，土地婆来做伙，文官无必徛倒边，武官领牌端正平，调查人间是非善恶，我拢知，
拢总知，
虎爷拍个神刀卡，变成驱魔，
够嘞，
以后搞你个低头皮。生来穿好势，
鸡一只，鸭一只，鱼一尾，猪肝一百，猪肉一大块。
六十点的休差日，烧一个金纸，门心跋杯。
哎呦，哪会跋无杯？
你是合杯？
哈哈哈，无酒跋无杯啦，啤酒还甜呢。
跋新杯，跋新杯啊，跋新杯，干啥喝一公杯？
他的梦想是想要飞上天，可是呢，没有翅膀要怎么飞？他心里还是想，长大以后就会有一双大大的翅膀。
Hey!
你可以飞，我们就结束了。你可以飞吗？
好啊，我飞给你看。
好啊，
马上就飞。好了，飞好了。
Coming to the end of the Mystic Pete Chronicles, you can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. In today's show, I featured Dr. Justin Sledge, who has a wonderful YouTube channel called Esoterica. Today's talk was on Lilith. Then we heard music by A Moving Sound. We heard Harvest, Starshine, The Master Size, Tao Te Gong, and just wrapped it up with Jump. I love that tune. You can easily find them on social media, A Moving Sound. We'll be back next week with the best of talk radio. Mystic Pete out. Wait. Stop the presses! I just came back from seeing Annie at the Dolby Theater. What an incredible show! Broadwayinhollywood.com.